Investable Universe is about thematic topics in real assets investing. This is what we mean by the global market of things: real estate, infrastructure, land, energy, and other commodities that have historically been viewed as boring old income investments. But take a look at the shifts underway in these asset classes, from industry disruptors to new investors to emerging markets to geopolitics, and you'll find these assets are very interesting. We'll talk about private equity, venture capital, corporate VC, sovereign wealth funds, listed markets, crazy startups, some old guard investment firms, some maverick entrepreneurs, and some paradigm-shifting technologies. One thing is certain, no corner of the global market of things will be left untouched by the changes happening right now, and that's what we talk about on this podcast. So today we explore the question, is renewable energy and its associated technologies, what falls under the category green tech or climate tech, in a bubble? A report released in the fall of 2020 from the accounting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers observed that between 2013 and 2019, early-stage venture capital funding in green technologies rose from $418 million to $16.1 billion, with a B, an increase of more than 3,750% during the period, or three times the growth rate of VC investment into artificial intelligence, which has also been identified as a critical emerging industry. So the climate change imperative is real, and few would argue with the halo effect of developing companies aimed at positive global change. But have company valuations risen too far too fast? And what does it mean for the energy transition and for private equity and venture capital overall? This is an interesting domain where these worlds collide. For insight into the dynamics of energy and green technology VC, I'm joined by Bennett Cohen, partner at San Francisco venture capital firm Piva Capital, where he invests in visionary entrepreneurs who are solving critical problems in the energy, mobility, and industrial sectors. Prior to joining Piva Capital, Bennett established the venture capital arm of Royal Dutch Shell in San Francisco, where he led investments focused on the future of energy. Before that, he helped to develop the strategy that underpins Shell's New Energies division, which develops business globally in renewable power and storage, smart grids, electric mobility, and energy access. Bennett, thank you for joining Investable Universe today.
Pleasure to be here, Rebecca. Thank you.
Awesome. So let's jump in to the first clean tech bubble from 2005 to 2006. Maybe we call this, I don't know, is this a forgotten bubble?
I would say a lot of people haven't forgotten.
Okay, they've not forgotten.
I think, there's a lot of investors that were active then that are active again now. But I would say there's a lot of investors across the spectrum who are hesitant to get back in the pool now because of that experience.
Okay, so since that, so they've been burned before, right? But since that time, I mean, the U.S. economy has been, you know, around the world and back, it seems like very accommodative rates for ever since the great financial crisis. We got a lot of money sloshing around the economy. It's looking for some place to go. Do you see a fundamentally different marketplace in 2021 than back in the day?
I do. I think this time is different. And there's a few different ways. So one important thing is that I think the market tailwinds are just howling, especially over the course of 2020, 2021, beginning of the year. We're just seeing commitments and pressure across all levels of society to decarbonize and to really get the world on a trajectory to avoid the worst impacts of greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. So you've seen the largest countries in the world, largest economies, China, European Union, Japan, Korea, not the US yet, but those other ones have all made net zero emission targets for, you know, average is around 2050. I've seen a lot of very big companies make the same commitments or more aggressive around net zero, including, you know, Amazon, Microsoft. So really the most powerful companies in the market right now. And then you're also seeing asset holders like BlackRock, you know, the largest asset holders globally, say, you know, they're going to be asking all their companies about how their businesses are resilient to climate change and what their plans are to reduce emissions. So all these things are adding up and they're creating a lot of excitement among investors to invest in the solutions that are going to help achieve these very aggressive targets.
So you've talked about the thematic imperative, as well as some very aggressive zero emission targets at the national level. But what about the venture capital landscape itself? And I ask this thinking of the emergence of some very well-capitalized investment funds like SoftBank, which have in some ways distorted the traditional VC funding model. They've priced smaller funds out of later rounds. Some say they incentivize growth at any cost, and that's a risk. Where do you stand on that?
I think you've seen the rise of the mega fund over the last years. SoftBank is the most extreme example, but you see a lot of other funds in Silicon Valley that are raising billions of dollars so that they can be competitive. And in some cases, you know, capitalize companies all the way from their very early stages all the way to an IPO. And so that's definitely changed the game. But you still see a lot of dynamism in the venture capital ecosystem, a lot of new funds emerging, especially thematic funds that are very specialized on areas such as climate tech, but also, you know, educational technology or mobility. And so I still think you have a very healthy ecosystem. I think on the SoftBank theme, you know, the new story that is familiar to SoftBank is the SPAC activity. And so that there's also a lot of capital coming in there, very high valuations. But I think for some companies it makes a lot of sense. And that those investments may actually, some of them prove to be pretty successful in the long run.
So you mentioned SPACs. I mean, those are special purpose acquisition companies that have sort of taken off with you're mixing metaphors here. It's taken off with a bang here, really, for the past, you know, 18 months plus. But it's really changed the structure, some of the dynamics in market structure. And what you're seeing through something like SPACs are a democratization of the liquidity event, an area where many retail investors felt that they didn't get to participate previously. Can you talk about how the market structure has changed and how these kind of democratizing strategies like SPACs or like, you know, expanded secondaries market or simply new PE strategies like growth equity funds affects green tech valuations?
Yeah, certainly I would say in terms of green tech, climate tech type opportunities, financing risk feels to be lower now. So, I mean, you sometimes see these very compelling opportunities to develop new technologies that the world needs to stay on a reasonable emissions pathway. But as an early stage investor previously, you would really kind of discount the opportunity a little bit if it needed lots and lots of capital, because it was just a risk. It could be very great company, very compelling technology, but, you know, are they going to be able to attract hundreds of millions of dollars to get to where they need to go? I think with the SPAC market, you know, the financing risk feels a lot lower right now. Of course, we'll see how it evolves. But the way I read a lot of the SPAC activity, beyond sort of the conditions in the financial markets generally right now, is that investors see where the winds are blowing as far as decarbonization and how much of an imperative there is for that in the global economy and how much demand there is for solutions. And I just don't think the public markets had caught up with the very fast change that we all experienced in the space in the last couple of years. And there just weren't enough public companies, right? So think about Tesla. I mean, up until recently, that was like the one opportunity to have a pure play investment on electric mobility, right? The future of electric transportation. And so I think there's lots of arguments for why Tesla is valued the way it is. And I'm definitely long Tesla. But one of the reasons is there just wasn't any other opportunity to bet on electric mobility. Now that's changed a lot in the last year. And so similarly, you know, same with autonomous mobility. Everyone knows that is a long-term trend that is going to be transformative. And there weren't a lot of opportunities to put your money behind it as a retail investor or public markets investor. Now SPACs are providing those opportunities. And so I think you're seeing that play out across lots of other areas that are relevant to climate change and the energy transition.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any hazard of SPAC, you know, the high level of SPAC activity resulting in, you know, money just being thrown at deals that should not get done? I mean, is that a systemic risk?
I think it's a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. And so I see very high quality transactions happening in that market. And I also see ones that I'm skeptical of.
Yeah.
And so I do think that the model and its popularity will be a durable trend for some time. But I do think it's a bit overheated at the moment.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about, we talked about what the market implications are for the sort of retail side of the market. Now turning to what they call the smart money, patient capital, the role of institutional and pension funds and their interest in seeking ESG exposure, especially in some emerging markets. Can you talk about how the demands of institutional investors, whether it's, you know, the top eight Canadian pension funds or a sovereign wealth fund somewhere, might change the playing field for startups?
Yeah, well, I think what we've experienced in the past few years is effectively ESG or responsible investing become the norm, mainstream. And so I think large institutional asset holders, such as the ones you mentioned, mm-hmm. Feel that if you're not assessing environmental, social, and governance risks in your companies, you are effectively, not being a responsible investor, mm-hmm. Leaving risks unaddressed and compromising value, whether it's in the medium term or the long term. Mm-hmm. And one principle that I find really helpful to understand, which that community talks about a lot, is this universal owner principle, mm-hmm. which is, you know, if you really are holding tens of billions, even trillions of dollars under management, you effectively own a slice of the global economy.
Right.
You own the whole economic picture. And so climate change is like the perfect example of what carbon emissions would be the perfect example of what a universal owner would really have a hard time with. Because if one company in your portfolio is emitting greenhouse gas emissions, which is a big externality, and it's impacting other companies, other sectors in your portfolio, you know, that's a suboptimal outcome at the portfolio level. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you're seeing asset holders really put pressure on their larger holdings to really improve on all these metrics. And so I think we hit a tipping point on that in the last, you know, call it couple of years, mm-hmm. where that is now a mainstream perspective in the institutional capital community. Mm-hmm. And so that's driving a lot of excitement in ESG and climate tech and all the spaces that we've been talking about.
So this frothy kind of interest in ESG as it becomes more mainstream, what is the broader market missing in terms of maybe risk exposure or maybe overlooked opportunity or maybe taking too much for granted about the green tech market in 2021?
Yeah, well, so I think in terms of ESG, you know, it's kind of the natural evolution of finance. So mm-hmm. assessing these risks and looking for opportunities in ESG in your portfolio, I think, is here to stay. I think similar to what we discussed about the SPAC market, you know, and when it comes to climate solutions, there is a lot of excitement or green tech. There are a lot of new investors coming in and maybe some that didn't live through that bubble that we talked about earlier in the episode.
Yep.
And so you do see, investors starting to kind of like dabble in science again, yep. versus sort of engineering risk, if you want to call it that, when it comes to technology. Mm-hmm. That was one of the big issues with that first clean tech bubble. You know, like I think a lot of companies, particularly in solar and biofuels and batteries, that still had a lot of fundamental science risk, were attracting a lot of capital. And so, someone said to me recently, science has no timeline. And so it's very difficult to invest there. And so I think that maybe is one lesson that was hard learned back in the 2000s, that not all investors active in the green tech market now are sort of remembering.
Uh-huh. So it's interesting. You mentioned science having no timeline, and that does make it difficult for, you know, VCs and some private equity players who need to generate returns from maybe getting involved in this market where there's a huge barrier to entry, where you have a lengthy regulatory process, especially if it's in something like, I don't know, some renewable energy forms like nuclear, for example, very, very long time to approval for some of these technologies. What's changed now?
A couple things. One, I would say, is there's a lot of new models out there that are designed to take these longer term, even uncertain time horizon type bets. And so you're seeing funds that have, you know, 15, 20 year horizons in the venture asset class. And so, you know, most vanilla VC funds are 10 years. And maybe they could be extended for a year or two or three. But these new breed of longer horizon funds are kind of designed to invest in things like nuclear. And I think you're just seeing a much more diverse playing field, right? So I used to work at Shell and our, you know, the venture capital arm of Shell was pretty, you know, venture horizon focused. But as a company, you know, they had other departments that could take longer term bets. And so I think what was very different from 2005-06 timeframe to now is like these industrial incumbents, whether they're auto companies, energy companies, other industrial companies, they really believe that the industrial system is going to change and that decarbonization is going to happen. And if they don't figure it out, you know, they may lose their license to operate or they're going to be disrupted by the next Tesla. And so, you know, you have these new funds, you have corporates that weren't there in the last wave that are there now, you know, looking, you know, for new business models, new technologies to drive their future in a decarbonizing world. You have family offices, which are very active. You have very wealthy individuals. You know, Bezos has $10 billion committed to this. Bill Gates has billions committed to this. So, you know, the financing landscape has really evolved.
So let's talk about Piva Capital. I mean, what are your investment criteria in terms of, you know, look at these wealth of companies and projects waiting to be funded or looking for funds? How do you separate hype from real thing?
Yeah, so Piva Capital is a relatively new firm. We launched in 2019, and we're investing out of our inaugural fund, which is a $250 million U.S. fund focused on the future of industry and energy. And so we are typically investing anywhere from $5 to $10 million at a time. And one way that we think about, you know, risk in this space is sort of by the stage that we focus on. So we're sort of a late Series A, Series B, maybe Series C stage investor. And we're typically looking for companies where there isn't a huge amount of science or technical risk. And ideally that's, you know, been put to bed or, you know, it's very close to ready for game time. Typically, the companies in our portfolio already have real revenue, you know, maybe not a lot of revenue, but call it in the single digit millions. And they're looking for that next tranche of capital to accelerate growth. And then most of the folks at the firm, they've been around this space for a long time. So, you know, myself, I was at a startup in that first clean tech 1.0 wave. Back in 2006, I started at a company called C-Power. Which was in the power, digital power space, call it demand response. And so, you know, I've seen the space evolve. I've seen things that worked out. I've seen things that didn't work out. And complemented by a long tenure in a company like Shell, where you also see, like, what does it really take to break into an energy market in a serious way? And then, you know, my partner, similar story. He spent a lot of time at General Electric working in their venture capital arm, you know, seeing a lot of things work and a lot of things not work, both inside that industrial titan, but within the portfolio of startups that were looking to really change, change the landscape. And so that, you know, I could talk about more members of the team. They have similar backgrounds. And then we also have a really great group of senior advisors who have been in the space even way longer than us. you know, fortunate to have backed companies like Tesla, like SolarCity, but also some others that, you know, were not happy endings. And so it's kind of that experience of investing in the space for a long time, you know, working inside the large industrial companies, mm-hmm. And then trying not to take huge amounts of technical risk.
So in order for a company in the green tech or renewable energy space to become revenue generating and or ready for game time, as you put it, what does it take? Do you need an IP fortress? Is that really what you're investing in? Or what are you looking for as the VC?
Yeah, IP fortress can be good, but it's not always kind of the critical ingredient for success. I think some sort of defensibility, some sort of moat is important, and that can be IP, but that can also come from a number of different areas. Mm-hmm. One thing that we look for is a solution that is not sort of depending on a green premium.
Mm-hmm. When you say green premium, what is that? What do you mean by that?
So not expecting customers necessarily to pay more for the solution because it's a zero carbon alternative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we could have carbon pricing soon. And so if you see, you know, a $40-$100 a ton price regulated, you know, that would certainly help some of those technologies get there and maybe eventually close the cost gap that they might have with the incumbent. But you know, we're not generally betting that carbon pricing is going to happen. Mm-hmm. We do see some sort of pioneering customers that are willing to buy or pay a green premium for solutions. Some of the companies we talked about earlier in the episode. But really, we're talking about big global markets. A lot of them are driven by commodity type dynamics. And mm-hmm. so we really focus a lot on unit economics, cost pressure in the market that's being entered. And margins, because a lot of the areas that we need to address, you know, don't typically have the margins that would support a venture capital type investment opportunity.
So can you talk about some of the companies in your portfolio that are delivering on those objectives that you're really excited about? They ticked all the boxes, let's say.
Yeah. So one company we just invested in that I'm really excited about is called Boston Metal.
Yeah.
And so this is a company based in Boston, mm-hmm. Which is commercializing some IP. And in this case, actually, they do have an IP fortress, as you put it, mm-hmm. Which is a totally different way of making steel from iron ore. Mm-hmm. And so most of the steel that's made from iron ore globally has coal as a key ingredient. Mm-hmm. And they're made in these huge blast furnaces that are, you know, cathedral sized industrial facilities. Boston Metal has a technology called molten oxide electrolysis, mm-hmm. Which is more of a modular, you know, small compared to that cathedral, but still pretty, you know, large, the size of like, you know, small, or a large room, call it. Mm-hmm. And electricity is the only energy input. And so mm-hmm. if you use solar and wind, it's a zero emission way to make steel. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those sectors that's 8% of global CO2 emissions. The sector is under tremendous pressure to decarbonize. Mm-hmm. And they really don't have a lot of technology solutions to help them get there. And a lot of these companies have also made net zero commitments. And so there's huge demand. But importantly, you know, the core technology is already commercial, mm-hmm. With a customer in the ferroalloy market down in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And they're not expecting any green premium as far as what the levelized cost of steel is going to be out of these systems that they're building.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So let's talk a little about your career trajectory, as it were. I mean, you mentioned earlier that you have some experience in corporate VC working for Royal Dutch Shell. What made you decide to leave the fold of corporate VC and strike out into an independent separate fund?
Yeah, so I had a great run at Shell, first in the strategy side of things, and then in the corporate venture arm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, wouldn't trade it for anything. I got to go see the, you know, travel all over the world, see, you know, different aspects of the energy industry. I got to, you know, work in China, in Europe, in the US. When Pivo was being set up, you know, it was kind of this new, exciting firm. You know, it was a chance to really build something from the ground up. You know, it was sort of like a startup. Mm-hmm. And so it was the same spaces to invest in that I loved that we were doing at Shell Ventures, but kind of an opportunity to, you know, join a nimble venture capital firm on the ground floor and really help shape it. Mm-hmm. That combined with the people that were already coming to the table, it was a hard decision, but ultimately, you know, it was an easy decision in the end. And it's been great the last 2 years, kind of getting it going and making the first initial investments with the team.
So as I understand it, Piva Capital has a single LP. Is that right?
Yeah, our first fund is backed by a single LP out of Malaysia. Mm-hmm. It's an energy company called Petronas. And their business footprint would be, you know, comparable to a Shell. And so kind of in the background, you know, there's a strategic conversation happening, which was very familiar to Shell. But we're an independent venture capital firm and there are limited partners. So just a little bit of a different structure.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, let's just clarify the structure a little bit. So you're a separate VC fund with a single LP that is an energy company, Petronas of Malaysia. And that is, so it's interesting. So in theory, is the difference between that and a corporate VC fund that you can bring on additional LPs?
Yeah, we could bring on additional LPs for a later fund. The other important difference is the investment decisions are made within Piva. And so for a lot of different reasons, you know, a limited partner wouldn't get involved in the investment decisions of the fund. Whereas at Shell, we were a strategic in-house corporate venture arm. You know, we didn't really have a fund per se. It was sort of off Shell's balance sheet. And these were investments that were in line with or complementary to Shell's strategy. Whereas the investments Piva's making are in a space that our LP is interested in, but they're financial investments that our firm is excited about.
So let's speak a little more broadly about the outlook for energy in the coming year. There are a number of themes that are being brought to bear here. The volatility in oil and gas prices that we saw last year, how that's going to recover. The debates over the U.S. energy sector due to what just happened in Texas and the blackouts there. The ongoing energy transition. The emergence of shareholder activists at oil majors like ExxonMobil. What's on your radar for this year?
Yeah, it's interesting. The oil price is always this important number, you know, in the green tech space. Because, you know, on the one hand, you know, when oil prices are low, energy prices tend to be low in general. And so it also makes, you know, although they don't always compete directly, but it also makes, you know, solar and wind electricity, you know, kind of a less energized market. If you will, are definitely things that compete directly, like biofuels or an electric vehicle, you know, has that much harder of a time competing economically with a gasoline vehicle when the gasoline you put in the car is extremely cheap. But, you know, when oil price is low, it also makes green tech companies feel emboldened, right? Because the big majors that are the incumbents are sort of not as strong per se. But, you know, I remember in the first clean tech bubble when oil was up at $150 a barrel, any alternative looked good. You know, biofuels looked great. Hydrogen looked great. It's a number that doesn't always have a straightforward impact on all the different facets of the market, but it is a very important barometer to keep an eye on. One of my old bosses, Amory Lovins at RMI, used to say, you know, don't make investments that hinge on the price of oil because then you're just a commodity speculator. And so I always remember that piece of advice. To your point about Texas, I think, you know, what you saw even before that, you know, think about some of the rolling blackouts in California during fire season, some of the storms, you know, on the East Coast in recent memory. There's a real premium for resilience. And a grid that is nimble, digital, with lots of distributed storage and generation and flexible demand capability. Mm-hmm. And so I think you're going to see a trend toward, localization of energy production, storage, and demand management. That's a trend that's, already been existing for a while, but I think is accelerating. Even the place where I am right now, a dinner table conversation is, mm-hmm. should we get a battery or should we get a generator? Because the power went out three times in the last, 6 months or something like that. So I think that's a dinner table conversation increasingly, in the US, but also in other countries. Mm-hmm. And then, other than that, I think decarbonization and a emphasis on green solutions is going to be a mega trend that just keeps growing.
So apropos of the term resilience and localization, what about the state of U.S. infrastructure? Because it seems as if even a majority of green tech startups are viable and they make money, these technologies have to be somehow integrated into a U.S. infrastructure system that is not great. C-, right? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it looks like, for the first time in a while, there's a realistic probability that there will be a big infrastructure spending package. And so, I think with the current administration, there'll be a lot of effort to steer that toward, solutions of the future rather than, solutions of the past. Mm-hmm. And so that should create, a pretty good playing field for some of the green solutions that are really based on infrastructure. But I think another interesting trend is really like the customer being in the driver's seat in a way that they weren't, in the past. And so there's more opportunities for customers of all sizes to buy solutions that weren't really ready for prime time in the past, whether that's rooftop solar or batteries, right? I mean, batteries mm-hmm. were just crazy expensive even 5-6 years ago. To think about putting one in for backup power, only was sort of, experimental mm-hmm. Or in very extreme cases. Now, getting a power wall or something else is kind of like, you could compare it to a generator, right? I think generators are probably still maybe cheaper depending, but so there's all these things that are mainstreaming. People are excited again about heat pumps, mm-hmm. Geothermal, new efficiency technologies, whether it's as simple as a thermostat, like a digital thermostat or even more extensive systems for customers. But you see this at the corporate level too, right? Companies are purchasing renewable power directly from solar and wind farms. Mm-hmm. Communities are trying to form their own energy cooperatives to buy, the solutions that they want. And so while infrastructure is very important and we need to improve the situation there, I think the consumer choice is kind of a new trend in recent, 5-10 years as well.
Do you think we'll see an infrastructure resilience venture capital fund emerge in the near future, or is there just too much government risk in something like that?
I think I definitely expect to see climate adaptation and resilience themed investing grow. Mm-hmm. I think, rightfully a lot of, or most of the focus in the community is on mitigating and mm-hmm. reducing emissions or capturing carbon. But I think unfortunately some of the impacts of climate change are here, and resiliency is one of the responses to that. And so I think you'll see more thematic investing on, resilience and adaptation as well.
Excellent. So finally, do you have any big news at PIVA or liquidity events you want to advertise or major market calls you want to make as we wrap things up? I know you're long Tesla. You said that.
Let's see. Well, we just invested in a really exciting regenerative agricultural technology company called Anuvia.
Okay. What do they do? That's the next big thing, regenerative agriculture.
So they take waste and they turn it into a organic fertilizer product. So it's replacing typically a petro fertilizer product. And it sequesters carbon in the soil and it boosts yields of the crops. So it's waste to value and, you know, has all these other great benefits and it's economic for the farmer. So we're really excited about that. My partner Oddsmel led that investment. So that's probably the most recent news that I can share. And on the exits, you know, we're knocking on wood, but nothing to announce yet.
Ah, knocking on wood then. Piva Capital, Bennett Cohen, thank you so much for speaking with Investable Universe today.
Thanks, Rebecca. My pleasure.
Awesome. That's all we got for Investable Universe this week. If you liked what you heard, share the link, check out the site at investableuniverse.com, or pitch us for future episodes. The address is editor@investableuniverse.com. My name is Rebecca Darst, and you'll hear more from me next time.